And so it gives me great pleasure to bring to you Yuri, and she'll talk about her own, whatever she wants to talk about.
First, I wish to thank Preston and, and Bill Sales and all the organizers of this conference. I feel it's a great honor to be here. I want to begin with a poem that was written by one of the well-known poets of that period, Ed Spriggs, who had just come to Harlem from San Francisco. I think he is in Atlanta now. He wrote this poem for Malcolm, and remember, this is 1965. There is no memorial site in Harlem save the one we are building in the streets of young minds till our hands and feet have strength to mold the concrete beneath our feet. Today's conference is one of the memorial sites, and thanks to people like Preston Wilcox and Kwani Somboro, who we used to know as Paul Boutelle, that they were the ones and the organizers too who were instilling into young minds the meaning of Malcolm. Malcolm's home was any and every black community, but in his last year, Harlem was his base, and the world was his planting ground of seeds that he dropped for the dispossessed and disempowered. All of us here were fortunate, or are fortunate, to have met Malcolm in person or through books or films or his writings or other people. My good fortune happened on September 16, 1963, in the Brooklyn courts at Skimmerhorn Street, when Malcolm came to check out the aftermath of 600 or so community activists who had been arrested during the summer of 1963. Some of you might remember. It was the fight for jobs for black and Puerto Rican construction workers. A year later, on June 4, 1964, he came to our apartment on 126th Street for the reception of four writers, all Japanese atom bomb victims who were traveling with the Hiroshima-Nagasaki World Peace Study Mission to Europe and on to Soviet Union. These four writers wanted to meet Malcolm more than anyone else in America. They wanted to know why this great big nation would be so afraid of one single black man. Our apartment was jammed with people, black and white civil rights activists, no nationalists, no Muslims, no Yorubas, just civil rights activists who were actually in a different world from Malcolm. They were all amazed at his graciousness, his sincerity, his humbleness, and his sensitiveness. You could hear a pin drop. After all, they had been reading and hearing nothing but negative characterization of Malcolm in the American media. His presence was electrifying. Malcolm revealed a deep and sincere interest in the devastating atom bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and especially in the four writers who wanted to meet him. He noted their scars and said that his people were also scarred by a different kind of bomb, the bomb of racism, which is as incendiary. When he was told that the writers had just come from visiting Jesse Gray's area on 114th Street, which at that time was called the world's worst fair in opposition to the then flourishing 1964 World Fair in Flushing Meadows, he commented on the physical scars of Harlem which had never been tended to because of an uncaring government. But he smilingly said he was glad that the atom bomb victims had chosen to see the world's worst fair in Harlem than the sumptuous and lavish World Fair in Flushing Meadows. His knowledge of Asia his perception of the world, and his understanding of people and their needs were impressive. One of the significant things that he said was, and remember this is 1964, before the anti-war movement, what America is doing in Vietnam is criminal. We see that the problem in Vietnam is the problem of the oppressed and the oppressor. The struggle of Vietnam is a struggle of the whole third world, the struggle against imperialist transgression. Our action here, he said, must be one of unity, and in the unity of oppressed people. Malcolm was truly internationalist, especially in his concern for oppressed people anywhere. Nationalism, as he defined it in the context of the Black Liberation Movement, came from the word nation. Nation, he explained, is land. Nation is government. Nation is people, heritage. Nation is culture and politics. Nation is sovereignty and self-defense. Nation is the making of history. We will never forget the seeds that he dropped, and we can see that they have taken root. When we think of organizations like NAPO, New African People's Organization under Ahmed Obafemi, or the Provisional Government of the Republic of New Africa, and what they have achieved and are trying to achieve. On February 21, 1965, when Malcolm was gunned down in the Audubon Ballroom on Harlem's West Side, a Japanese socialist journalist was present. He was probably the first of Japanese writers to bring to Japan the story of Malcolm. A few late years later, by the end of the 60s, two members of the UCLA's Asian American Studies staff were sent to Japan to help translate some of Malcolm's speeches. In the early 60s, when student activities were at its height in Japan, some of the progressive Japanese colleges instituted some courses in Black studies in the curriculum. But I wonder if Japanese students really grasped the meaning and significance of Malcolm's life. Economic success in Japan, triggered by advanced science and technology, has created a generation of materialistic, bourgeois cultural, wealth-oriented, prestige-seeking mentality of youth and of parents. And though Japan has a huge peace movement, issues like human rights, justice, and marginal people are marginal indeed. And they are also oblivious of the fact that in this country, Blacks and Latinos are in the forefront of the struggle against racism, hypocrisy, duality, and seek with zeal human dignity and equity. When we think of some of the recent blatant racist remarks made by Japanese leaders and so casually, it reveals the chauvinist, insensitive, despicable elitism of the mentality of contemptuous contemporary leadership. Whenever we meet young people from Japan, we ask them if they are aware and mindful of the lies and false impressions spewed by Japanese bigots about Blacks and Latinos. We tell them they must immediately condemn and challenge their leaders. For not only are Blacks and Latinos angered, but all righteous people, including progressive Japanese and other Asian Americans, who are not only embarrassed but infuriated by Japanese racism and chauvinism. It is the same racism which has historically derogated Koreans, Chinese, Filipinos, and other Asians. But getting back to Malcolm, in the late 50s, Palestinian activists from the Middle East told us that names like Malcolm, Stokely Carmichael, and Black Panthers were used as code names among the guerrillas. Also in the same period, Vietnamese activists here told us that Malcolm's name was known in radical circles in their country. It may have been through Robert Williams, who was in Vietnam at that time. In the last years of Ho Chi Minh's life, He was informed during a birthday celebration that Malcolm X also shared the same birthday. In 1985, I met a renowned Uruguayan playwright, novelist, poet, and Christian minister named Iber Contreras. He had come out of prison in Uruguay, where he was tortured and incarcerated for 8.5 years. He was in New York on a speaking tour. He told me that he had written a play about Malcolm. I was astounded. I asked him, how did he know about Malcolm? He said he was in France in 1965, when Malcolm's autobiography first came out. He said he was so impressed by Malcolm that he went home to Uruguay and wrote a play which was performed there before he was in prison. He said that same play was presented in Cuba in 1967, in Chile in 1969, in Czechoslovakia in 1970, and in Poland in 1971. Iran has also honored him with a stamp in 1984. Beneath Malcolm's picture, it says, Universal Day of Struggle Against Race Discrimination. Malcolm had really only 1 year of his life that he could call his own, from March of 1964, when he bolted from the Nation of Islam, to his assassination date, February 21st, 1965, where he was not under the jurisdiction of any organization or leadership. In that 1 year, he internationalized the struggle of blacks in America, connected it with Africans in Africa and in the diaspora, made his Hajj or pilgrimage to Mecca in Saudi Arabia, debated with British scholars at Oxford in England, went down to the Black Belt South to meet with student and community activists, spoke with Mississippi high school students right here in Harlem, and had a private conference with Fidel Castro of Cuba, and in general, dropped seeds of common sense, revolutionary wisdom, and hope throughout the world. Malcolm's greatness, which spans the world, is boundless, imperishable, peerless, and momentous, because it is rooted in humankind's eternal and common struggle for human rights, basic needs, dignity, self-determination, and survival. Malcolm X is an integral part of the new Africans' ongoing struggle in America. Although he did not call himself a new African at that time, because that name is fairly new, if he had lived, we feel quite sure that that is what he would have called himself. He certainly would not have put American in any part of his ID. He is, by development and commitment, a new African, but recognized and acclaimed as a fighter for justice and self-determination internationally. While he lived, America's newspapers denounced him as a hater. But it is enlightening to note that what he hated were tyranny, oppression, disfranchisement, exploitation, enslavement, whether physical, mental, or psychological, race humiliation, stigmatizing, stultifying conditions, limited job opportunities, inferior education and substandard housing for his people, economic and political aggression internationally, foreign intervention and encroachment, and the degrading and embrutement of human lives, like the warehousing of black men in prison. Yes, he was a hater. In his brief lifetime, he hated with fierceness the horrendous, confining, and unjust prerequisites manifested in this country, Africa, and elsewhere, which decent people anywhere should hate and counter. Few, however, have such courage. Most people assuage and mollify their protests for the sake of racial harmony and ameliorating race relations, thus digressing from the objective of fighting the evils in society. What he loved was carefully omitted from the white press. He loved humanity, the quality of being loved. He loved dignity, the attribute of being esteemed. He loved justice, the principle of dealing justly with people, all people. He loved freedom, the state of being free, the absence of restraint or repression. He loved life in all its wholeness and beauty, unconfined and with passionate compassion. Regardless of race, religion, citizenship, to have lived in the same era as this remarkable man is a personal gain of new perceptions and the affirmation of humanity. The words of a 19th century English poet, Sir Henry Taylor, I would like to use, for it epitomizes the magnitude of this phenomenal new African. Quote, such a soul whose sudden visitation dazes the world, vanishes like lightning, but he leaves behind a voice that in the distance far away wakens the slumbering ages. And I would like to end with Carl Russell's poem, which he wrote about the same time back in 65, The Promise We Must Keep. Put a torch to the robes of mourning and don your sheath of armor. Listen for his clarion blast, for he is not dead. His potent voice can still be heard within the confines of our hearts. Put a torch to the robes of mourning, for he walks the streets of Harlem and every ghetto belt, and proud, erect, a man. Put a torch to the robes of mourning, for the earth in whose breast our warrior rests, battle-scarred but unvanquished, will blossom with his love for us. Put a torch to the robes of mourning, for he is not dead, we all know. You can feel him when the blood rushes in your veins, and every drop that's filled with fire is but a semblance of his name. Put a torch to the robes of mourning, for he would not have us weep. Let not our own brave lion sleep. To fight that he shall live is the promise that we must keep.